From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning. Focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Hour. This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. And we're rejoicing because by phone we are being joined by Sister Josephine Garrett. Sister, good day to you.
Hi, hello. Good day to you. How are you doing?
Are you still in Texas, or have you moved on?
No, I'm in Tyler, Texas now, so I'm still in the great state.
You're where in Texas?
Tyler, Texas.
Oh, Tyler, yes. Oh, well known. And you're a native Texan.
I am. I grew up in Houston. I lived in Dallas. So Houston half my life, Dallas half my life, and I've been here in Tyler. This summer will be 3 years.
Wow. So Houston and Dallas, a few people in California, we've heard of those cities. I remember one time looking up the population. I think I was in the fifth grade or something, and we had to learn the populations of some of the major cities, and I couldn't believe how big Houston was. It was like, wow, have to visit there.
It's so much better than Texas, because in Texas, our geography is only Texas geography.
Yeah.
And we are so ignorant.
Texas tends to have that reputation of being almost a country unto itself.
Yeah. Like, if you literally, without conscious awareness, if a Texan is traveling outside of the country and someone says, where are you from? We say Texas.
Texas, yeah. You don't even say where from.
People outside of Texas will say America, and it took me a while to realize I was the only one saying Texas.
Yeah.
<That's great. laughs>
So tell it. The reason we're having you on, of course, Sister is going to be one of the featured speakers at On Fire, which is the NorCal Jam in September at Six Flags Discovery Kingdom in Vallejo. Have you ever been to Vallejo?
I have not, so I'm excited to come and meet well and see the place. So I've never been there.
Yeah, I heard you have to come a day early and try out all the rides and make sure they're safe.
Yeah, I don't do roller coasters. I tested the roller coasters to see if I still like them a couple of years ago, and I no longer like them.
That's, you know, it's weird. I hate to say it, but it's and I'm saying it because of my age. It's an age thing. The older you get, the less you like roller coasters. There's no way around it. Going around upside down just is not enjoyable.
This is not what it used to be. Mm-hmm. Now, I will say, one of my sisters who is the same age as me, she still loves them. So we rode that roller coaster together, and as I was hanging upside down in the air, I was saying to her, why are we doing this?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Well, so tell us about, you have a very interesting vocation story, I think.
Okay. So the short version is that in Houston, I did grow up Baptist and attended the University of Dallas and became Catholic a couple of years after graduating.
And so you were not Catholic when you went to the University of Dallas?
No, I didn't know.
But that is a Catholic school.
It's a very Catholic school, which I did not fully understand when I enrolled. Mm-hmm. So I graduated with working in banking. I ended up working in banking for over a decade. And after becoming Catholic, I got a chance to go back to Rome. I lived in Rome as a student at the University of Dallas. I got a chance to go back after becoming Catholic. And so then 4 years after becoming Catholic, so it was in 2009, I entered the community, the Sisters of the Holy Family of Nazareth, as a candidate. I was very surprised by religious vocation. I thought I would stay in, you know, the banking working world and make money and retire and buy stuff in between. But that's not what God's plan was.
So were you attracted to banking?
Not at first, no. So at first, the reason I took that banking job is because it started out as like a simple frontline job. And when I graduated from school, I just I just thought that, you know, I need a job. I picked the first kind of basic, well-paid, with benefits job I could find, but then started, you know, being promoted at the bank. And so eventually I loved the work that I did there. I had the huge privilege to help develop new leaders. So I managed an operations floor that was divided into teams, and the team leaders would report to me. And I would be given a lot of new team leaders and had the huge privilege to, like, accompany them as they figured out how to be leaders. And this was wonderful. And then I got to be trained and learned how to project manage large-scale projects. So I was also a project manager. So I eventually loved it. I didn't go to the bank because I knew I'd love banking.
Wow.
I went to, so I could pay bills and have health care.
Sure, sure. That's pretty much the way most of us started in occupations, and some of us got lucky and fell into something we really love to do.
Yes, I enjoyed it.
Wow.
Very much. And I'll tell people, like, all those gifts, I use my project management skills constantly in ministry. And I use those people managing, people developing, kind of those types of skills constantly in ministry. And so God hasn't wasted any of that by any means.
Can you get me a lower interest rate on my credit cards?
Probably not.
No.
If I had those connections, they're probably no longer what they used to be.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting world for sure. And so how do you use what you learned? And I mean, because, you know, we always say God works in mysterious ways, and we're all a product of our history, you know, the things we've learned along the way, and we think, well, that doesn't relate at all. But you're saying that what your time in the banking industry helps you now as a Catholic nun.
Absolutely. I mean, so right now, my first ministry after graduating, I'm a counselor, I'm a licensed counselor, is the ministry that I have right now. And the first ministry that was assigned me when I was graduating with my master's in counseling and getting my license was to start a school counseling, like a mental health program in a Catholic school that had no program. And the skills to do that well are not only mental health skills. You have to be an expertise in mental health, but there would also have to be an expertise in project management. So how do I design the program? Who do I speak to before I start designing the program, right? Because if I design in a silo, it's not going to be for the people. It may look lovely on paper, and I think this is probably something our church could stand to hear, right? It may look perfect on paper, but if it wasn't designed with conversations with people in mind, it really won't be for them. So, like, how to do needs assessments and needs surveys and how to put together a project plan and how to put together an implementation plan for a program, how to assess it along the way to see if this is working for the people, like continuing to survey them and making adjustments as needed. So others are actually not counselor skills, they're program and project management skills. And so even today, I'm still leveraging those skills.
So you're now a licensed clinical mental health counselor?
I am, yes.
Yeah, and How long of a program is that to learn everything you need to learn to be licensed?
The program that I participated in was one that would make it to where my license would be accepted anywhere in the nation. So it took me almost 4 years. I just did some more work so that way if I left Texas and went to a state that had higher standards, I would not have problems and be needing to go back to school again. So it took me almost 4 years to prepare for that.
Wow. Is that all on a college campus?
It was both. So I was in like a blended program where I had in-class classes as well as online classes, as well as like, you know, classes that had me doing both, you know. So it was a mix.
Now, do you do a lot of speaking to Catholic groups?
Yes, that has grown a lot over the years. I got to take a break from it. It was born in just going around and sharing my vocation story. I was working with a ministry called Liberate Society. I currently serve as one of their board members, and I was working with that ministry and the ministry that helps future priests and religious raise money to help remediate student loan debt. And so, which can get pretty expensive, but needs some remediation before you move forward in your vocation. So I learned to tell my vocation story. And so people would say, we know you're fundraising, but can you also just come tell your vocation story? And then eventually they started saying, well, can you speak about these other topics too that are, you know, that maybe matter to you and others? And so it was kind of born in that. I had to take a break from it last year because it was my year of preparation for final vows. So I made my final vows in November of last year. And so now that I am past my year of preparation for final vows, I've kind of started taking more speaking and reading opportunities again. But I tell people that's like my side hustle, like my main heart belongs to my kids and clients who I encounter as a counselor.
So when you became into the church, at that point, did you think that you might be pursuing a vocation as well?
Absolutely not. I mean, that could not have been the furthest thing from my mind.
Mm-hmm.
It was just not even a part of, like, it wasn't even a part of, like, my sense of the world or, like, my sense of an identity as a Catholic woman. Mm-hmm. I don't have words for how far that was from my mind.
And so what changed? What, mm-hmm. did God call you in the middle of the night?
That was the middle of a retreat. when I had gone to Rome that second time, when I was Catholic now, a group of my friends, we woke up early one morning, like we had an off day. We were going around with mm-hmm. our choir that we sang with and singing. And she had given us the day off. And so we said, we're going to get up early. We're going to go to St. Peter's when nobody's there, where you can really experience the beauty mm-hmm. in quiet and stillness. And then go to confession, go to Mass. I was at St. Peter's going to confession and Mass as a Catholic for the first time. And I had a really meaningful confession.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at a point in my life where I was a decent Catholic. You know, if I struggled with great sin, I would go to confession as often as I needed to, try to be at Mass every Sunday. So it was kind of like that baseline kind of Catholic Sunday. And it had been really nagging on my conscience to do more with God, for God, with the church, and for the church. And I had not been doing it. I had just been completely disregarding my conscience. So I was confessing this to this priest, my own disregard and disobedience when it came to, like, what the Spirit was placing on my conscience as the next call for me. And he listened. I was crying, and he listened. And he said two words to me, just begin.
Mm.
So I went home, and I did that. And I thought, okay, I like young people. I enjoy young people. I think I'm kind of cool, so maybe they'll like me too. And so I said, I'll go volunteer to help the youth group. And I was a small group leader. And I would go once a week and help them in their small group after a large group and help chaperone retreats. And one day I was on a retreat, and we were all before the Blessed Sacrament. And I was just glad to be where I was, and I was glad for everything that was changing and had changed in my life, and I was just offering a prayer of thanks to God for all of the graces that needed to occur for me to be someone who was grateful to be chaperoning a youth retreat on a Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And in that prayer, I thought to myself, it would be wonderful to be a sister and serve the church in this way.
Wow.
And I had never, I mean, it was the strangest formulation of a thought to me. And I almost kind of tried to reject it and put it away.
I was going to say, did you try to chase it away? And
I did. I was like, it doesn't make any sense. And so I opened my eyes and was kind of starting to put this aside. And a sister walked right by my face as a way to, like, make me unable, you know, to put it away. And so my conscious awareness, I would say, of God's call for me began in that moment. Continued to persist for years, processed with the spiritual director, was given the opportunity to meet sisters and what going. I went kind of as a wingman for a friend of mine
mm-hmm.
to a come and see, and I ended up being her maid of honor. And that come and see I went to as a wingman is the mm-hmm. community that I'm a part of today. And so, that's how that that's how that started. If anybody had asked me in 2005, I would have said it's not possible.
Mm-hmm. So how did you pick the Sisters of the Holy Family of Nazareth?
So my friend was visiting them, and she didn't know that I was thinking these thoughts about the sister. I hadn't told her. We were out to dinner one night, and she said, "Will you come with me?" And I didn't tell her yes. I actually told her I'd think about it. But then as it got close, she just left directions on my voicemail, and I didn't have the heart to call her back and tell her, "I didn't tell you yes." So I just went, and that's how I met the sisters. And they're funny. They'll say that first day I walked in, some of them will tell me they knew. Like, so they looked at
really?
Me, and they were like, "We will say, yeah." And I was like, "I don't know if I buy all that, like, if it's a little sentimental." But they say, some of them say they looked and they knew. I was super anxious that first week, and I remember not sleeping well and feeling like the pillows were too thin and just being very uncomfortable and feeling socially awkward. But I wanted to go back again, and so I kept going back. And the reason I chose the Sisters of the Holy Family of Nazareth because it just, all of the, like, fears I was struggling with, it couldn't stand up, like, in the face of Nazareth, where it's like, because what's characteristic among our sisters is that, like, in our ordinary life, in our ordinary relationships, like, God's love reigns. And so it's so important in our community that we're not putting on piety or putting on holiness or making, like, extravagant situations for ourselves to presume ourselves holy, but that, like, in all that's going on in our lives and all that's going on in our diverse and distinct personalities, ethnicities, families of origin, stories, in the midst of all of that, as we encounter each other, God's love reigns. This was so attractive to me. I was like, this I can do, you know? I can bring myself here and contribute and receive. And so it was just like a process of finding home.
Did you feel there were things you were leaving behind that you had to, you had to juggle and go, you know, I want to go this way. No, I want to go that way. No, I want to go this way. Did you go back and forth?
I didn't do a lot of back and forth. That hasn't been a part of my vocation story. I didn't do a ton of back and forth. I had a couple of moments there where I was like, Lord, I don't think I can do it. Like, I can count on one hand where I was like, ooh, this is going to be harder than I think I can do. But, yes, my job. If somebody would have asked me in the beginning of all of it, like, what would be hardest to let go, I would have been like, my apartment, my car. It was my job. I didn't care about that apartment. I did not care about that car. I maybe shed a tear or two over the dog. I just didn't have the reactions I thought I would. But my job, I had really begun to, like, wrap my whole identity up in that like, success and having titles and being respected and being in charge. And,
sure.
So when I left that job, it was incredibly painful for me. So.
Yeah, people, you know, it's there's a lot more than money in a job. I mean, just, you know, job satisfaction is one of the number one things in people's lives, you know, and the people that go to work every day and hate their jobs are, you know, it runs their life, you know, and the ones that love their jobs, it's like they get a smile on their face all the time.
It's
difficult stuff. Did you have family you had to convince or that tried to talk you out of it or tried to encourage you to this in this direction?
It was a mix. So yeah, each of my family members kind of had their own perspective on it, and this was tough. I mean, trying to manage all these experiences, but my superior general at this time said something so wise to me that I know I'll never forget. She said, you know, God gave you the time you needed to come to acceptance of his call for you, and you owe your family the time as well. And so she was really teaching me, like, to lay off trying to convince them and have arguments and just to really, like, give them the time, you know, try to give them at least some of the time that God gave to me and continues to give to me. And so, yeah, so, I mean, it was a mix. I'm adopted by my aunt and uncle. They raised me. So my uncle is my uncle by blood, my aunt by marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So my aunt grew up in a small Caribbean country called Dominica, which is a very Catholic country.
Right.
But we all went to Baptist church growing up, but she's back in the church now. She goes to Mass now and adoration.
Oh, great.
But at the time, she wasn't, but still very much has this Catholic identity. So once she knew I was entering the convent, it was like I was already a nun. And she would tell everybody, my daughter is a nun. Like, she felt like it, like, you could tell she felt like it gave her street cred. My uncle, he was just more, he's kind of a more cautious, like, observing type of man. So he kind of was open, but just like taking it all in, you know, like seeing like, what's this about? They would stay at the convent and they would come and visit, which helped a lot. Like, eat meals with the sisters at the tables with the sisters. And so my aunt and uncle, my parents, have spent the most time out of my whole family around and with the sisters. And so have made some really beautiful bonds and relationships with them. My brothers were, one was pretty ambivalent. Like, he did the whole, I don't get it, but you do you.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my brothers was more aggressive. He was like, I don't know why you would think you need to do this. You're not going to be able to do what you want to do.
Right.
He was like, you're a cute girl. I don't think cute girls are supposed to be nuns. Just kind of all kinds of things. But I remember when he told me you won't be able to do what you want to do. I looked at my uncle, who had been married, like, by that point, like, 3 decades.
Uh-huh.
And I said, Uncle Billy, how often do you get to do what you want to do?
Oh, that's funny.
He's like, it's not often. I was like, exactly.
So, wow. So, the Catholic Church itself, though, you had a religious background, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, very much.
Was there one thing that made you cross that line, cross the Tiber, as they say?
From Baptist to Catholic?
Mm-hmm.
The Eucharist.
The Eucharist, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Like what it meant for.
Mm-hmm.
Just what the Eucharist meant for, like, I guess the way to say it, like, growing up, we'd come out of church, and it was like, oh, church is good because the pastor really preached. Church was good because the choir really sang. And
right, right.
Becoming an adult woman, I could see clearly it doesn't matter what your church is. It's just full of super broken people. And so I realized I wasn't going to be able to do life looking to, like, temporal realities in order for my experience of God to be good.
Mm-hmm.
And my relationship with God to be good. So this notion that, like, that pastor, that bishop, that choir, that homilist, that deacon could get it completely and utterly wrong, and my church would still be good because of the Eucharist.
Right.
Meant a lot to me.
Wow. Well, and it's a historical fact. This is the church that Jesus Christ founded. You know,
right.
There's no arguing with that. Nobody argues about that, you know.
And he founded it this way for a reason.
Right.
You know, he came as our high priest because, I mean, this happened this way for a reason. I think it's so, it's just so important that in, like, the times that we're in that we remember that we have people who are helpful to us, you know, who help us in our relationship with Jesus, but do not expect them to be our ultimate high priest.
Right.
Because we will be disappointed eventually, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. We're speaking with Sister Josephine Garrett. She is coming our way to the Diocese of Sacramento for On Fire, Six Flags Discovery Kingdom in Vallejo, the final Saturday of September, the 25th of September. And it's for youth and young adults, and a day in the park where you can ride the rides, and also a wonderful, you know, vocations carnival, exhibits, great food, great buffet lunch. And we're not going to do it virtually this year. The numbers will be controlled, but things are pandemic-wise getting much better in California. And Sister will be one of the featured speakers. What do you tell teenagers, let's say, at an event like this?
I don't know. I don't know yet. I know the title of the conference is On Fire. I don't know yet the prompt for the talk that the people planning this retreat for young people are hoping for. I know it's the talk that is before they spend time in adoration of the Lord. And so I guess I want to say to young people, like, if you really want to be on fire, like you want your heart to be inflamed with a fire that nobody can take from you, it's got to be the Eucharist. And it's got to be the Eucharist. It's got to be Jesus. It's got to be identifying first and foremost as God's child. We spend so much time coming up with things to identify as. I mean, it just, we have never-ending list, you know, of what we identify as. We just go love. We love amassing label after label. But if you really want to be like an unquenchable fire in the world, then at the end of the day, that's daughter, son of God, in adoration of the Eucharist, and close to the sacraments, and you will always be relevant. You will always be relevant. You will always have something to say. You will always have something to proclaim.
Do you think that youth today, I mean, what are their, I mean, you deal a lot with youth. What are their challenges? What is, you know, it's just sort of like, I don't like to say, what do they want from the faith? You know, the faith is the truth, and the truth stands alone whether people believe in it or they don't believe in it. But you know, and it's frustrating when you hear people say, well, I didn't get much out of Mass today or something. What, how do you deal with that notion? You know, what, like, youth are, you know, they're demanding, and you put it so beautifully, the Eucharist. Is it possible an awful lot of us, wishy-washy, lukewarm, whatever you want to call it, fallen away, really don't understand that that's the body and blood of Jesus Christ?
Or, like, understand is one word, but believe. You hear Jesus using this word all the time, that, like, we're saved in our belief.
Mm-hmm.
And so that puts us in a whole other reflection. Like, yes, if I look at a Catholic child, yeah, there are some, when I read study, there are some who do not know that this is the body, blood, soul,
right.
And that's one matter, it's a teaching matter. But I'm not quite sure if we are stumbling and kind of falling on our faces in our efforts to evangelize because the mass majority don't have the knowledge. I think it's a belief matter. Which comes down to relationship. And so I think the first thing with our youth is, I love all the turning up and the having fun. I love that, but I just wish as we as ministers would increase our faith in the simplicity of putting our youth before the Eucharistic faith of Jesus, and to understand that that's our greatest effort. You know, we're putting forth effort in, like, so many areas, but sometimes I think we don't feel confident that the simplicity of Eucharistic adoration over and over and over and over again, letting our kids encounter Jesus in the Eucharist will help our belief, like help our unbelief. So that's the first thing I would say. And the second thing went right out of my mind. It was another one that I think is so important when we're trying to like help kids. Yes, I remember once I was helping a diocese read diocesan synodal data. So they had like a diocesan synod on youth and young adults, and they needed a team to kind of read on the various topics and try to come up with themes.
Right.
And so I had youth and the topic of like sexuality, I think, is what I had. And I read something in there that it will never leave me. And it says something along the lines of, the church is not where I come to understand what to do about the difficult things in my life. The church is not where I come to understand what to do about the difficult things in my life. So drugs and alcohol and peer pressure and sex and same-sex attraction and domestic violence and experiences of neglect, physical abuse, and sexual abuse. The church is not where I come to know what to do about that. So I think sometimes we don't know how to hold the space for these really big and difficult topics. And either we're way too far on one end where we're like, you do you, Jesus loves you, or we're way too far on the other end where we're, you know, slapping people over the face with rhetoric, you know, slick-tongued rhetoric that gets a lot of clicks and follows. And it's not a lot of, like, holding space, speaking the truth, and speaking the truth while accompanying.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think those are the two things I would say, like increased fidelity and the power of Eucharistic adoration and doing more and more to make our church a space where we can come, not have all the answers, but a space where they come to grapple with some of these really big things going on in their lives.
Yeah, and accompanying, I think that's huge. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's one thing to tell someone this is the truth, and it's another thing to accompany them as they're struggling
Amen.
With it. Yeah.
Amen. Yeah. It does take a lot of effort to, like, rouse righteous anger, spitting truths up, you know, one after the other. It takes a lot to accompany.
That's right.
Yeah.
Indeed. Well, sister, we look forward to you coming to California. And,
Thank you.
Weather should be just perfect. You know, we don't have humidity in California, not like Houston.
It is very humid outside today. It is quite disgusting, but I'm glad the sun is shining. And we have field day tomorrow, so pray for us to have a clear sky for field day.
Very good. We will.
Thank you.
Safe journey out here, and we'll see you in September. Thanks so much for all you do. God bless you and your work, and safe journeys out here.
God bless you. Thank you.
Hey, thanks so much, sister.
Mm-hmm. God bless. Bye-bye.
That's Sister Josephine Garrett, who will be out here for the On Fire at Six Flags Discovery Kingdom in Vallejo. We'll give you more details, but you can learn all about it at scd.org. It's another young adult ministry program. It was started here in the Diocese of Sacramento, but involves youth from all over Northern California, and the Diocese of Reno always brings a large contingent of youth as well, all day at Six Flags in Vallejo, Saturday, the 25th of September this fall. So in person finally. This will be wonderful. We'll take a quick break, back with more on the Bishop's Hour right after this. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour. We'd like to thank all the wonderful people and organizations, businesses in town and throughout the Diocese of Sacramento who have provided underwriting for the Bishop's Hour, some in the last few years, some have been with us for a very long time. If you would like to be an underwriter for the Bishop's Radio Hour, it's a wonderful opportunity to support this mission and also to support the diocese and also to get some recognition for your organization or for your business. So the easiest way to do this is to give us a shout, send us an email, radio@scd.org, and we can give you all the details about helping to underwrite the Bishop's Radio Hour. Again, that's radio@scd.org.
This is Lincoln Snyder, Superintendent of Catholic Schools, and you're listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Dunning.
Thank you, Lincoln. I appreciate all you do for our great Catholic schools here in the Diocese of Sacramento. Well, Sister Catherine Doyle joins us by phone. Sister, good day to you.
Well, hi. How are you?
Good. You know, I checked with the county health department to see if we could do this in person.
Uh-huh.
They told me that you don't have to wear a mask if you're doing it from home on the phone.
That's true.
So one day it will be in person, I hope. One day soon. Yes. Yes. But it's good to hear your voice. It's good to have you on the program. How are you managing this pandemic?
Well, you know, it's a wonderfully reflective time, I guess, is a good way of putting it, because, you know, you're really not as torn by going out to a lot of stuff anymore while you're on Zoom and that kind of thing. I think most of the people that I've been talking with find that it has pushed them to think about what's really important to them.
Mm-hmm.
And has renewed a deeper sense of the value of connectivity.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that being isolated from people you love and care about, not being able to see people, has reinforced the importance of those relationships. And I think, you know, that's a blessing within the pandemic. I think the flip side of that is, for a lot of people, they have been isolated because people haven't reached out to them, or they don't have a lot of connections.
Well, I mean, we've seen, and you know, just very unfortunately, you know, the amount of mental health difficulties, the amount of people with other diseases that weren't necessarily fatal dying of those diseases, not because they got COVID, but the isolation. We've seen suicide rates spike dramatically. And
All of it
points to this is, you know, connectivity where I guess maybe we always knew that, but this is really dramatically pointed out to us how important that is, that connecting with other people. And I know, you know, and it varies from person to person and family to family and situation to situation, of course, because, I mean, some people did lose loved ones, lost their lives,
mm-hmm.
or got sick
mm-hmm.
and haven't gotten better. We've, for those of us who were fortunate enough not to get sick, I know in terms of family time, it has been enormously wonderful. There was no soccer practice, no volleyball
uh-huh.
practice, no choir
uh-huh.
practice, no nothing. Everybody was home at dinner time, and it was just like, how do you tell a teenager, no, you can't go to choir practice at 7 o'clock because we eat dinner together? You know, it's like, and it's hard, and virtually every thing that happens that's so-called extracurricular either happens after somebody's work day
mm-hmm.
or after school, and usually involves evenings, and people who are active and they're on they're doing good work, they're doing the Lord's work, they're on a board of directors for a great organization, but they're meeting at night, you know, this was different. By golly, we've had some. I actually learned all of my kids' names, which
isn't that wonderful?
It's wonderful. I just call them by their age. I know you're 13.
Yes, I think that is one of the learnings, and I think one of the other things which has made the time difficult for many people is that they have defined themselves, unfortunately, by what they do rather than who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden they're not doing.
They're not doing, Yeah,
they're not doing it in the same way, and they've had to really try to negotiate that sense of, you know, I am a child of God.
Right.
I am of great value, not because of what I do, but because God loves me and made me.
Right.
That's a whole different stance than we're used to thinking about on an everyday basis.
And you're so right about connectivity. Just to the people that even live in the same town, whether it's a grandchild or a grandfather or mother or an uncle, that they're in the same town and you couldn't see them.
That's right.
Sadly, a number of people who broke the rules paid a real serious price for it, you know.
Uh-huh. And, oh, yes.
And you think, oh, man, we're doing a good thing. We're celebrating somebody's birthday in the backyard. You know, we're not doing an evil thing. We're not robbing a bank. We're not, you know. And this is a good thing. And, you know, everybody gets sick. You know,
it's a whole many, many learnings. There's a poem that was written by a gentleman by the last name of McCormick, and it's on if I have learned anything,
mm-hmm.
or if this has taught me anything, and it's a long poem, and it was a wonderful kind of vehicle for people to use and to think about what have you really learned during this period of time. And to name some of those. And also, I think, to allow people to experience and name the grief that they've felt over mm-hmm. this period as mm-hmm. well. Because there's a lot of ungrieved losses from this time.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And hopefully, what's it? Last name's McCormick? I'm going to have to look that up.
I think it's McCormick, uh-huh.
Are you just quoting him because he's Irish?
No. but, you know, one of the things I did learn during this time period was how to give a retreat or facilitate a retreat
mm-hmm.
online, which is, a whole other challenge when you do it by Zoom. And I found this little thing on YouTube.
Hmm.
And it was a wonderful kind of vehicle for retreatants to use to begin to reflect on their experience.
Wow, that's great, because I think one of the things that we have learned is how connected we are in that way, how really simple the technology is from a user standpoint in most cases, and that we can reach people far away and have meetings that we used to think, well, we got to do it in person, and somebody's driving an hour at 7 o'clock at night to make a meeting, or just doesn't come, you know. Well, that's too far. I can't do that on a Tuesday night. I got to put the kids to bed.
Right. I think one of the potentials that I certainly see from this time period in our diocese, because our diocese is so vast,
yeah.
and we have so many parishes that are really remote. And I mean, I remember when I worked for the diocese, it was like almost 7 hours between Sacramento and Alturas.
Right.
But now, because of the pandemic, we've really learned how to use some of these media tools to bring spiritual opportunities to those parishes that they didn't have before.
Right, right. In fact, I'm one bold example is our Catholic schools, which managed through great effort of all the administrators and the bishop and the teachers and the parents and the kids to actually do a lot of in-person much uh-huh. earlier than other schools were able to. But they still obviously offered the online for those that it was circumstances or whatever required that. And they know that there will still be enough, but it was done school by school. You're the math teacher uh-huh. and you're doing in-person and online and
right.
every school was doing that, and they came up with this brilliant idea, and now that they're going to go full bore back to in person in August for all the schools, that to serve those in need who still need the online, let's have one online academy with dedicated mm-hmm. teachers just to that, free up these other teachers who are really doing double duty. And now they have one online academy that's going to start up in the fall to serve the people in Alturas could now send their kids to Catholic school and mm-hmm. truly couldn't otherwise. It was probably closer to go to a Catholic school in Klamath Falls than it, or Medford mm-hmm. than it would be in the diocese. And
right.
And I don't know how many takers they're going to have, but it's a wonderful opportunity for people in the so-called remote areas to have a Catholic education, and it spreads through everything. You know, your ministry and everyone's ministries, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. where we can reach people we really weren't reaching before.
Well, and I think it's an opportunity right now for us also to really rethink some of the ways in which we do religious education
mm-hmm.
for children in public schools.
Right.
Because we often have the issue of transportation or mm-hmm. availability, all of those kinds of things, where we have now the opportunity, perhaps, to do some more virtual and family things online
right.
that allow a single family home to be able
right.
to be with the kids at night and not worry about leaving them home and taking some out, all of those different things.
Exactly. And the vast majority of Catholic kids are in public schools.
Yes, very much so. And it is not an area that I think we have put a lot of resources into
mm-hmm.
In terms of creativity of what can we do better in that field to make it more accessible to more families.
Well, this is certainly a golden opportunity in that direction. And speaking of
mm-hmm.
kids, the Eucharist. And mm-hmm. one of the topics we had chosen, Eucharistic spirituality with children.
With children. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do our, you know, oh boy, I can barely remember back to my first communion, other than I think I had to put on a tie for the first time in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it was a very hot day, and for a long time, you're standing out in front of the church. Sometimes you're in line, and sometimes you're waiting to get your picture taken. I remember all those things.
That's right.
But, you know, sometimes I think, you know, my mom was a convert, converted in nursing school, a Catholic nursing school, and she said the nuns had something that I wanted, you know, she
mm-hmm.
said, the way they right. lived their lives. She said they didn't even try to convert me. They just the way they lived their lives. And
mm-hmm. Children, you know, there's a huge difference between the way you teach older children and younger children.
Mm-hmm.
Because the younger children, and that's still, you know, your first communion age
right.
Kids. They learn by absorbing.
Right.
And you can teach them all the information in the world, but they have to absorb the experience.
Right.
And I think one of the best, I think I've mentioned this before at other times, one of the most profound documents I think that the church ever shared was the directory for children,
mm-hmm.
which talks specifically about the way in which children have to be prepared for Eucharistic celebrations. And I know, you know, I never taught the little ones. I always taught, you know, adolescents for mm-hmm. most of my life, or adults. And I remember having my own little nephew over at the convent one night after school, and I was setting the altar. And the parish church didn't have a tabernacle veil, but the convent one happened to have one.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was looking at it and looking at it, and he finally asked me, what was it?
Uh-huh.
And I said to them very simply, you know, well, that's where Jesus lived.
Uh-huh.
Things the guy was doing really good here, okay? And he was very quiet.
I
thought he was awfully quiet for a while. And finally, he pulled up my skirt, and he looked at me, and he said, but how does he fit? And I think that really tuned me into the fact that, you know, the way I think as an adult and the way I think that children hear things
Mm-hmm.
Profoundly different.
Yep. Yep.
Never in my wildest dreams would I think that he would have interpreted my saying that's where Jesus was as Jesus curled up in the tabernacle.
Exactly. Yeah.
Literally, you know?
Yeah, and kids tend to, most kids at that age, be very literal, especially when an adult's talking to them seriously.
Exactly. And what this directory says, and I think that's one of the reasons why I think it is such a serious statement for them to make, is that prolonged experience to something that is unintelligible to children can cause serious spiritual harm.
Hmm.
You know, the church doesn't usually talk that way, but that's what they're saying in one of their documents, in the sense that children have to understand or at least be able to enter into the experience of Eucharist on a level that is appropriate for their development.
Exactly.
And so, you know, you think about some of the things that are important, and this directory goes on to talk about some of the very human things that children need to have the experience of in order for them to experience Eucharist. And one is a community activity.
Hmm.
That children have to know what it means to be in union with others,
mm-hmm.
in order to understand Eucharist. Because how can you say we come together as one people around the altar if they don't have any sense of coming together as a community? What does that mean? What does it look like? And, of course, the family, you know, home, ideally, would be providing some of that experience of community. But on a practical basis, we know that many homes are fractured.
Mm-hmm.
And many homes are torn in so many directions that the children don't expect that. They don't get a real sense of community in the sense that it can serve as a bridge into Eucharistic experience.
Yeah, you know.
Another, you know, thing that the document talks about and the church tells us is children have to learn how to express gratitude. And, you know, that's a lot easier said than done.
It's a lot easier said than done. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, Eucharist and Eucharistic spirituality is all about being grateful for what God has done for us.
Mm-hmm.
So how does a child appropriate that value of being grateful for life, for what people do around them, and for them, for small kindnesses? You know, are they grateful or are they taught how to be grateful for those kinds of ordinary things?
Mm-hmm.
They sound so basic, but they're essential for children to enter into Eucharist. They're just as essential on one level as it is for them to understand, you know, the difference between ordinary bread and Eucharistic bread.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's important for them to know, but that is not the only thing that is important for them to know.
Yeah.
They also have to understand, again, going back to that document, they need to understand what it means to seek and grant pardon.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, they're not harboring resentment in their heart, or they're not approaching the Eucharist with a sense of being estranged from their classmates. And, you know, someone was telling me the other day about a situation where there was a celebration. You know how parishes are doing things online?
Right.
And so, you know, they had an online celebration, and sure enough, you know, they had all sorts of negative chat being put on. Well, you know, how can you reconcile that
right
with the action of what we're really doing. What are we really celebrating? So there has to be this harmony between word and deed. There has to be a harmony between the child's life experience and what they bring to Eucharist and receive them at Eucharist as well. And parents, you know, can know how hard this is. They have to learn how to listen, because how can they hear the word of God if they don't listen?
Yep.
And parishes have to make sure that they provide the option for the younger children of children's liturgy of the word, so that they hear the readings on their own level. They don't understand Father's homilies because they're not at the age of maturity to understand what God is talking about most of the time.
Well, truly. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the church provides for that by having children's liturgy of the word.
Sure. Sister, we have only scratched the surface here, and I'm already getting the the signal that we've run flat out of time. We have to have you back soon.
Well, it's been lovely being with you.
Yes, you too, as always, and I hope we can get you back on soon. And meanwhile, God bless you and all the great work you do, and we'll pray for all those kids.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you, sister.
Take care, Bob.
Yeah, you too. That's Sister Catherine Doyle, and what a treasure she is here in the Diocese of Sacramento. That's going to do it for us for today. Thanks for listening. God bless everyone. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the Mercy Foundation, enriching lives in the Sacramento region through Sisters of Mercy ministries in healthcare, education, housing, and the care for the poor and elderly. For the Mercy Foundation, philanthropy is one of the most powerful expressions of compassion and love. Just as many people in our community need a hand, countless others are reaching out to them with comfort and hope. You can express your care and concern for the less fortunate with a gift to the Mercy Foundation. You can give them a call, 916-851-2700. That's 916-851-2700. And you can be confident that fully 100% of your contribution will support the Sisters of Mercy Ministry or ministries that you choose. And what a wonderful treasure Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts has been for all of us here in the diocese as they transition into new ownership and management. They continue to offer wonderful workshops, wonderful resources for the Catholic community throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Not only does Easter's provide a wide array of Catholic books, both current releases and longtime classics, but they also sponsor a number of valuable workshops and lectures throughout the year. They're located at 6916 Sunrise Boulevard in Citrus Heights. Give them a call, 916-338-7272. We also receive a generous underwriting support by Crumley & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. If you have questions about retirement, Crumley & Associates can help you with their confident retirement approach that can help define a clear roadmap to get you where you want to go. You can contact them, get all the details at Crumley & Associates, 7956 California Avenue in Fair Oaks. They're at 916-638-4600. That's 916-638-4600. And we are certainly appreciative of the fine and longstanding support of the Mercy Foundation, of Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts, and of Crumley and Associates.
Hello, this is John Watkins, Director of Catholic Charities and Social Concerns. You are listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Dunning.
To the cross I look, and to the cross I cling. Of its suffering I do drink, of its work I do sing. On it my Savior, both
bruised and crushed, showing that God is love.